in the Western Hemisphere, it's good morning. We'll begin with a common mention of for everybody here in the lodge. Thank you for coming and helping us to maintain a fragrance-free zone for the benefits of those with sensitivities. Thank you. Also, for our friends out in Zoom country, please, if you would, please try to remember to keep your microphones muted during the presentation, and definitely unmute when you're ready to talk, and then remute, please. And if you care to get up and walk around with your iPad, please try to remember to shut off the video because it can be a little distracting. Thank you. We will begin today's presentation with a volunteer reading the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists.
The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basic. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by studying otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect. It belongs to each and all.
Thank you. Well, here at the Lodge in Philadelphia, we support the principles of the declaration by holding three meetings per week, such as on a Sunday morning. The lodge opens at 10:30 in the morning. And we have on Sunday mornings from 11 to 12 noon is a presentation each week. For each month, there's an umbrella theme that ensues during the Sunday meetings through that month. And this month, for the month of May, the umbrella theme is psychism and spirituality. Psychism and spirituality. The presentation today is entitled The Lore and Danger of the Seance. And this will proceed according to a panel discussion. There'll be two people who give different presentations together that complement each other. And then the floor is open certainly for questions, contributions, and discussion. On Wednesdays, we also have meetings. We are studying The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. The lodge opens at 6:15, where there is a reference library available to the public from 6:15 to 7:15 with all philosophical straight line material available for your personal study. And then at 7:30, the meeting begins, and it's from 7:30 to 8:45. There's a presentation of the part of the chapter, the few pages we're addressing that week, followed by plenty of time for questions and answers, as all of our meetings have. Both the Sunday meeting and the Wednesday meeting are carried on here in the lodge and on Zoom, as you can see, and all are welcome to attend. Then on Friday, we have meetings that are strictly Zoom meetings, which is, we call that the Theosophical Roundtable. And that is conducted on Fridays from 6:30 to 7:30 online only. which consists typically of a, you know, each of us reading a particular article which is sent to us during the week, and then engaging in discussion and thoughtful questions and back and forth for the hour on a Friday evening. The lodge is sustained entirely by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. No one who you see talking or contributing their time or services is paid any of this money. Every donation goes to what? To keeping the lights on and keeping the building maintained for the public to promulgate the teachings of Theosophy. So that said, we will start with the first presentation, which is entitled The Lore and Dangers of Seances. And for tonight's presentation, when we use the word seance, we're actually going to liberalize that word and let it refer to any kind of mediumistic practice, channeling, so to speak, psychic endeavors, heaven knows what else. So that's what we're going to invite questions and discussions regarding the law and dangers of. So the question comes, why are people so interested in the metaphysical? What is the lore of the metaphysical? It's popular to use the word supernatural, but in Theosophy, really, we understand that all in manifestation is a part of great nature, both seen and unseen. So everything is natural. And the word supernatural is an oxymoron to the student of Theosophy. We make the distinction. The distinction to us is very important. Now, last week, our discussion was as above, so below, where it was discussed that man is a microcosm of the entire universe, or said differently, that each man is a universe unto himself in miniature. If this is the case, then we can see, or we can make a little more sense of the third chief object of the Theosophical movement, as found in the Key to Theosophy. What is that? The third object of the Theosophical movement is to investigate the hidden mysteries of nature under every aspect possible, and the psychic and spiritual powers latent in man. To investigate the hidden mysteries of nature under every aspect possible, and the psychic and spiritual powers latent in man. So then, there is the natural, innocent, healthy curiosity about metaphysics. It's healthy to have this kind of a curiosity. It's a part of who we are. The lore is because the good people of the world simply are naturally, whether unconsciously or consciously, they naturally want to learn more about themselves, and this is a good thing. Something about us is hidden. It is said there is something within us, within our own nature, that is mysterious, psychic, spiritual. This is the third object. And that we want to know more about it. But because of the entire lack of awareness of the inner nature of man during this our cycle that the world has been in for the past 2,000 years, many of us are raised in homes where the principles necessary to naturally investigate and to know it are left entirely out of the picture. In short, most folks have no idea, but that doesn't mean we're not curious. We are raised in a very material environment. That's not to say an immoral environment or an unethical environment, but an environment which premises that the physical is the first reality, the only reality that can practically be known. Well, the student of theosophy would say it's very healthy to question that premise. But we have a caveat. The caveat is that it may be helpful to live by the maxim that morality and ethics is metaphysics 101. If you're going to investigate metaphysics, morality and ethics comes first. So let's get back to the universe for a minute. In The Key to Theosophy, HBB tells us deity is the eternal, incessantly evolving, not creating, builder of the universe. That universe itself unfolding out of its own essence, not being made. Deity is the eternal, incessantly evolving, not creating, builder of the universe. That universe itself unfolding out of its own essence, not being made. So let's apply this to the microcosm. In terms of the Hermetic axiom, as above, so below, the spiritual soul of every human being is the eternal, incessantly evolving, not creating, builder of oneself. That spiritual soul itself unfolding out of its own essence, not being made. At issue here, because there is power associated with it, the more one learns about the inner nature of oneself, whether one knows it at the time or not, the more potential risk one assumes. It's a double-edged sword. Even if he learns false ideas and hurts himself or others by acting on those ideas, and even if teaching those false ideas, or rather, and even if other people use these false ideas and hurt themselves with them, there is a certain karma to that in which so-called the teacher participates. So with that, we're going to pass the talk on to our fellow student, and he will address the dangers.
So the third object is the investigation of psychic practices, psychism, the hidden laws of the universe. And that is quite, there's quite an allure to that. But we are warned constantly about it. And why? Because of the whole history of psychism, which is as old as the world is. In the beginning of the world, the beginning of this period of manifestation, not at the very beginning, but the separation of sexes into the present bodies that we have now and the lighting up of Manas, which is the mind principle, we had choice. We have free will and choice. And of course, although there's very little that we're told about, we came over from a prior period of evolution on the moon chain. And the moon is actually our mother. It's the dying corpse. And we are slowly absorbing its principles. And there are nefarious principles and there's beneficial principles. All is dual. So we can go way back in history where there's witches and people possessed and different psychic practices and voodoo being the most known, we would think. And it's still around. And there are seances still around. I mean, we haven't personally come in contact with anything of that nature, but now, as was said earlier, there's channeling, there's many varieties. So what is it? We're seven principal beings, and our kama principle is our middle principle, kama meaning the desire principle. Originally, kama is a force for good, but as our karmic heritage from prior periods of evolution, and of course, during the 18 million years as mind beings, with the light of manas, the light of mind, being lit in us, we have responsibility. And these responsibilities are for the evolution of our human race, but also to bring up those below us. Now, mediumship, in particular, seances, were very popular when the Theosophical Society was founded in 1875. Prior to that, HPB had been doing investigations. H.P. Blavatsky, the chief founder of the Theosophical movement, the modern Theosophical movement, she had spent about a year in Philadelphia, and she was investigating psychism, spiritualism, and whatnot. And we're not going to go into detail, but one can look up the Holmes controversy that's in A Modern Panarion. And she initially was sympathetic to the mediums and the mediumistic practices because they were onto something. These things are real, and we'll just, we'll quote real. There is an astral realm, which really is very real. And it's full of devilish, all the good, the bad, the ugly is all in the astral. And we're completely surrounded by the astral sphere. We're totally surrounded in it. We're like we're swimming in it. And so HPB originally came upon various, and Philadelphia was a hotbed of psychism and mediumship and seances. It was one of the leading centers in the United States. And two, we were the second largest city in the US back then. We're nowhere near that now. But the concentration on the East Coast, and also it's the aftermath of the Civil War, and people were grieving because it's still the bloodiest war we've ever been involved with. 750,000 lives lost to various causes. A lot of it was the aftermath of wounds and not treating the wounds correctly. So she investigated these psychic practices. So a medium is tapping into, through a seance, is tapping into this astral forms. Now, when there's suicides, there's murders, there's accidents, the being loses their corporeal physical body, but the astral body, the design body, where our real senses are, is still floating around out there. So we had this great period of grieving and loss that the Fox sisters, of course, actually go back to the 1840s. And so people were very influenced by it. And at the time, too, there was the whole thing with there was the abolition of slavery movement. There was the movement to enfranchise women to get the vote. The women's liberation started right around that time. The Industrial Revolution was full steam ahead. And so there was this great swirling mass of humanity. And there were all these people who were curiosity seekers that were very much attracted to seances. But what happens is the medium conducting the seance, and most of them were all fraudulent too. And that's the whole thing. H.P. Blavatsky was sympathetic to them and hoping that she could teach them the real philosophy behind all this. But they really ended up turning on her because they were so involved in the lower senses, the passions and desires, all that stuff that the Kama principle is. So we're trying to raise the self by the self, but they rejected her for the most part, not entirely, when she started criticizing and pointing out the fraud that was going on. There was a lot of money that was made playing on people's sympathies as well. And whenever money is involved with anything spiritual, it's no good ever comes of it. So the medium that conducts the seance has to put himself or herself into a very passive state. And by doing that, it opens a door. It opens a door to this astral world. And all these executed criminals, suicides, and whatnot, that are looking for what's known as a factitious, vicarious thrill of working through the sitters, it comes into play. And it's the worst kind of pollution, because psychic pollution is the worst kind of pollution that there is. So it is also when this was not done with the lights on, this was smoke and mirrors, paid actors, trap doors, all that kind of stuff that if you've seen movies about this, you're familiar with. So we are warned throughout the Ocean of Theosophy and through other works that also mediums are, they're psychologically and physically putting themselves at risk. They're not, you know, they're unstable individuals. So we're warned not to mess with this stuff. So what does Theosophy teach? It teaches the philosophy behind it. It teaches the reasons for it. And it teaches avoidance. There's something called mediatorship, which is the opposite of mediumship. And that is, you know, consciously working with these forces. So we're going to end it there. Every year we study the ocean, and every year we're warned against these psychic practices, hypnotism as well, which is another passive state where we're mind beings, and we're here to try to elevate ourselves and to learn the ethics and the morals and the philosophy of Theosophy, which is it's science, religion, and philosophy rolled into one. So we'll end it there. So we have ample time for discussion.
Yes, in the back.
So we know that the medium can be affected by the actions that they're doing during a seance, but the people that attend the seance, are they affected by these dregs of the lower astral?
Well, yes, they are. People, whenever there's a skeptic, a strong scientific skeptic, really it interferes with the whole operation. If there's, if in a well-lit room, it does as well. So these are people who want to believe. They're being preyed upon. They're passive and they're being preyed upon, and they want to believe. There's never been any philosophy that's been put forth at these meetings. But ironically, every now and then there has been a disembodied voice that's basically said that, you know, this is all fraudulent. So it's kind of ironic in a way. It's not, yes, the answer is yes, because they have to put themselves into a passive state, and passivity is not good.
Chase, yes.
In the current United States, there's a lot of this stuff going on TV. There are readings being done across telephone wires and on Zoom sessions. Things are posted on social media left and right. Is there also a degree of danger for those seated in these public audiences where they're witnessing natural or flim-flam readings of auras?
So yeah, all right. So the question is, the audience participating in these readings or in these channelings, what's the danger? Well, certainly, if there's any kind of passivity, and even there can be kind of a collective hypnotism that goes on, then you're open to the suggestion. Open to what suggestion? Well, first of all, open to the suggestion that what's going on is true, that we really are speaking with the spirit of Uncle Paul, when nothing could be further from the truth. What's going on there is this willingness to open oneself to something out there. Remember, the word is something out there that you're willing to accept as some kind of valid form of communication. You're putting yourself in a receptive or actually a passive position. So even being in the presence of a medium, much less sitting and participating in a seance, when the medium is making him or herself passive, you're in the presence of a nefarious energy, a nefarious astral being that could be considered. Any other ideas along that?
Only that they ask leading questions, and often, a good medium can read the astral and see, you know, what's in there. But there's all kinds of degrees. But a lot of times leading questions are asked, or there's a questionnaire in the audience ahead of time, or there's plants in the audience a lot of times to kind of reinforce kind of like a third party validation, which is another thing with sales, a lot of, and it's salesmanship in a sense, but it's psychics salesmanship where they're selling a defective product and a dangerous product as well. Yes, behold.
Certain mediums at least try to put their services to the cause of resolving some kind of injustice that happened in the case of like forensic scientists. Do you think that the dangers would outweigh getting justice in those circumstances where somebody's in a dire need to solve a murder case?
Good question.
Good question. Well, if they're able to do it, they're able to do it, aren't they? Now, the question is, you know, our concern is not so much, you know, the outcome of the case. I mean, if they help to solve a missing person situation, But our concern is the right use of one's inner powers for the good of all, with the right purpose. So if there's somebody out there who knows they can help, who can call the whatever authority and know it's the right thing to relieve the suffering and do it in such a way that's anonymous, without being paid, keeping oneself very impersonal, but they know it's the right thing to do, well, it would seem that is the spiritual use of power. As soon as the person puts a condition on it, says, I want a check, or put me on the news because this is what I do for a living and I want people to get to know me, that's when we're not accusing people of being bad, some good people who are trying their best, but that automatically takes it out of the spiritual realm and into a psychic. And the issue here is what's going on in the psychic. It's the use of metaphysical powers for our own personal service, in service to what I want to get out of this. And that's kind of dangerous. That's kind of Adam and Eve eating the fruit from the tree of knowledge. That's dangerous, rather than doing it because it's the right thing to do in the right situation, regardless of whether or not I'm going to get something out of it under karma. However it works out, it works out. Maybe that's something that all psychics, all people who are developed in certain ways can think of it.
So high-minded pure mediums do exist, but they're very rare. And the charging of money just taints it automatically. Did MDW, you look like you were about to ask a question. Is that true? Is there a chat too?
There's a chat.
Well, yes, I was about to ask the question.
Well, go ahead.
We were considering, you know, growing up, there were people on television that would be able to cure people. They would walk on stage and they would lay their hands on them and they would more or less be cured. And even today, there's these mega churches or these organizations that, tell people what they want to hear. And they raise lots and lots of money. First of all, are these psychic? Are they, I would think they would be preying on our psychic nature, our feeling nature. And, is this something that we should really, you know, just take note of? I guess we can't do anything about it, but just take note of it.
Well, certainly that goes on, and certainly we're not here to sit and point fingers and condemn anyone. However, let's just, and let's say even that's going on without any money exchanging hands. There is a story in the philosophy, or it's actually in the historic record of the philosophy, that one of the founders of the Theosophical movement, Colonel Olcott, who was the president, definitely had this kind of an ability. He could lay hands on people and heal them. And at a certain point in his career, one of HPB's teachers actually told him to stop it. Why? Because he didn't understand at the time, but it was draining him of, we'll call it, life energy at a time when he had a purpose to fulfill. And were he to continue to use it in that fashion, then interestingly, his higher purpose to fulfill was not going to be available to him. So maybe that's something that we can take to heart.
Yeah, yes. There's something about mesmerism, which was known originally as animal magnetism, that first of all, we have our astral body, but we also have another principle is prana, where there's prana and jiva. Jiva is universal, prana is particularized in our being, but it permeates all our principles. And what is it? It's breath or life force. We're also warned against breathing, breathing practices, and against hatha yoga, because it's all of the lower physical nature. So it's a combination of the astral and prana, and it does drain the individual. It takes away, and Colonel Olcott was warned to stop to doing it, to stop, you know, that practice. And he was one of the three original founders, and he was the long-term president of the Theosophical Society as well. And he lived to be about 75 years old, so, which was a good long life back then. But if he had continued that practice, there's, you know, he probably would not have lasted that long. That's mere speculation, of course. So there's a chat here. Okay, just somebody saying that was a very good question. Okay, so so where are we going next with this? Okay, there's another one here. Here we go. What about ghosts? Are ghosts astral bodies of dead people that linger in haunted houses and in graveyards? Okay, let's address that. What about ghosts? Well, they are shells. The real person is gone. So it's not the real person. Some of the astral dregs, elemental forces, which we haven't addressed yet, and elementaries, which are the shells of like executed criminals, they're to maintain their astral body, and suicides, and also accidental deaths. And if it's an we'll just use the example of an executed criminal because that's the one that's generally used. They're full of anger and resentment, and they want to get back. So they're devilish, to use, you know, I guess that's the best word we can use. They like to wreak havoc. They enjoy it. They're very, very dangerous, and they can be attracted, and they can be very powerful. They can be attracted to the seance rooms. They could, I guess, they're various other places as well.
Yeah. We found that as we learned more about this by studying theosophy, we've kind of just left the word ghost out of our vocabulary because it's just such a nothing word. Once we find that there are so many different things going on when we learn about this through studying theosophy, that the word ghost kind of applies to everything. If you believe in ghosts, and whereas a student of theosophy, as was just mentioned, has learned that it could be a lot of different things, as he mentioned, elementaries, which are the shells of deceased persons, or the person is still present in their astral because of the, what, as he was saying. So this word ghost, which comes from the meaning, like a gust of wind, like a breath, you won't really see that in theosophy, but if you're going to apply it to all these many different metaphysical beings in the astral, then perhaps we could say, yeah, well, they're ghosts. Yes.
Back to Theosophy Hall.
Well, isn't the whole idea behind these shells is that they're attracted? I mean, there's a strong attraction between the shell and the place maybe where the accident happened, you know, after they die, they don't, you know, there's an attraction, whether it's an emotional attraction to somebody or, you know, a material attraction. But isn't that one of the reasons why we supposedly are able to see these shells?
Well, let's take a look at that. Like, why even are there these shells, these astral bodies? The better word that we could use is kama rupa, because what that is the desire nature of the human being is in the form of the astral. So it coalesces with the astral. It's not the case for all people who die. Why are there kama rupas? Well, it depends on how the individual leads his life. If we live our life in such a way to be a good person, morally, ethically, we understand things are here to use and we're grateful for the experience, but we're not attached to it. We're not selfish. We're not ambitious. We're not trying to build some kind of a power base to control people and own this and build this desire, lower ambitious nature in ourselves. Those people who do, that lower ambitious nature outlives the physical body. So when the body's dead and the immortal soul goes on to its next stage in Devakan, there's still a real astral, so to speak, being, which is there floating around. And what directs it? Personal desires. It is magnetically, not by decision, not intellectually, it's just magnetically attracted or repulsed by things in its nature, in the surrounding nature. So, in other words, these are just the remnants of a human being that haven't disintegrated yet. And the issue is, you know, whatever goes on with that shell, the soul, you know, there's karma there, and the soul is still responsible for, even though they're not present. Why are they still? Because they created it.
Yes.
And so ideally, when we pass and the body dies, there's still those remnants, and it passes on in the weeks or months or however short amount of time, and it doesn't take on, so to speak, a life of its own, and it can't be vivified.
Yeah. So there's the death of the body, and that process takes about 12 hours, where there's an after-death review of the entire life from every angle, every event that ever took place, even things that we weren't really that conscious of that took place around us. And then there's the kama rupa is the body of the passions and desires. And there's a second death. It's like a second death. And then liberated from the body. And Devakan, the after-death state, which is the place of the gods, it's a heaven-like state where all the higher aspirations go on. But if you're trying to attract these people that are on their way, and you're doing them a disservice and you a disservice. If you're trying to attract these spirits of your loved ones that are going through that second death, which can take years, but it can take 15 minutes there's no time limit. It can be very quick. Some can move right on. If a pure person, a really holy person who's led an exemplary life, would just like, if they kind of like zip on by to Devakan and maybe have a very short Devakan and come back because the most altruistic and the most materialistic both actually reincarnate quicker than the average, which is 1,000 to 1,500 years. But we do not want to mess with these forces, because if we're trying to attract and can contact loved ones that are going through, we don't want to vivify those shells, that we're doing them a terrible thing by vivifying those astral shells. It's the worst thing you could possibly do to yourself and to your loved one, really. Did you have a follow-up or not? No? Good. Yes.
Yes, the ones.
So, if talking to someone then, and they say that they want to contact a deceased loved one, and they were going to go to a seance, what would we tell them? I mean, should we try and talk them out of it?
All right. So, yeah. So the question is, you know, well, suppose someone we know is interested in this kind of stuff and they're going to act on that interest. You know, first, let's ask the question, why does theosophy teach this? Why does the student of theosophy spend the time to learn about this? We spend the time to learn about the dangers of it so we understand the dangers of it and not to mess with it and to share these ideas with others, because it's all a part of the teachings of theosophy. So someone who has studied this compared to someone who has like no idea but thinks it's really interesting, one might find that what comes to mind just intuitionally, the words that come to mind intuitionally when having this conversation can be very effective in opening the eyes of a friend who is considering this. And we wonder if they will realize how much more you actually do know about this stuff. You don't have to, you know, don't regurgitate everything, but give them a few ideas. It's like, how do you know that whatever's there is not becoming involved with you? How do you know it's not becoming a part of you? And questions that help them to see their own ignorance on the matter can be helpful. Any ideas?
Well, you could, you know, it depends on people want to, you know, if they're curious, they really, really want to go, then we can just try to give them some philosophy and some warnings the best we can. But we can also ask them, you know, why do you really want to go? Do you really think you're going to get anything out of it? It's maybe you can try to counsel them. It's better to just let them go. Think of them as they were. Because the thing is, the best they can get is like somewhat of an image floating around and a voice that may very well repeat some of the facts of the life of the decedent. But there's no new knowledge. There's no new philosophy. There's nothing to be gained, really, except for a morbid curiosity. But unfortunately, morbid curiosity is really very popular. We can try to dissuade them, but maybe they need to go through that experience too, and in order to see through it. But if they go there and we've given them a little bit without overdoing it, because you can oversell something and really turn somebody off, and then they're so we have to tread lightly.
MDW, did you
go ahead, MDW?
Yes. We know the Catholic Church has a lot of rituals that are very old, and but there's one called, there's one known as exorcism, and we've always wondered, is that a reality, or is that something made up by Hollywood?
No, it's a reality. They had that for certain priests are trained as exorcists, and they try to downplay it and do it. Of course, there's the movie that back in the late 60s or early 70s, whatever it came out. But we don't know how effective they are. We couldn't speak to that.
But let's face it, that's why we're taught these things in theosophy so that you don't have to go through that kind of an experience. It is an experience. It is something that happens to people. Whatever that is, we're not going to pretend that we're an authority on it, but a study of, you know, it's, we don't even know that it's worth the individual's time. Probably studying the ethics of what metaphysics can be in one's life. So let's take a look at that. You know, we've talked about mediums. In a nutshell, what's a medium? A medium is someone who sits passively, opens their inner nature, opens their physical body to whatever's out there, and they don't necessarily know what's out there, and allow that thing into them to use this body to impress other people sitting around the table. Meanwhile, where's the soul of that medium? Somewhere else, has no control, doesn't know what's going on. When he or she comes back, has no idea. Why? Because it's a passive experience with another entity influencing all the people sitting around. Wow. Just wow. Now, what's the opposite of a medium? The opposite of a medium is an adept. What's the difference? An adept is an individual who takes responsibility for everything he does, has complete control of his lower nature, his higher nature, and even the elemental forces around him. He lives his life in a mindful, controlled way with a purpose. It's very helpful to read. It's in Isis Unveiled, page 587, where HPB just explains the difference between an adept and a medium. And then, of course, the question often comes up, and it was touched on earlier, well, wasn't HPB a medium? Didn't the Mahatmas work through her and help her to write the books that she wrote? And the answer is no, it's completely different. Why? Because HPB made the choice to allow that to happen. The word a mediator, to allow that to happen, which is only done under certain circumstances for a higher purpose in service to humanity. And the person who is the mediator is present, 100% present, is in complete control, knows exactly what's going on, and can stop it at any time. So that's the difference. So we see a difference between an adept and a medium. And then also a mediator, that's helpful to clarify some wrong ideas about HPB. Now, in terms of the student, there are probably a lot of metaphysical things about us, as interesting as this is, that we could take a lot more control of. And we don't even give it the time of day for the most part. Things like, how's your mental health? How's your emotional health? How are you living your life? When you make a decision to learn something, do you focus, do you study, do you control your mind? In the sense that it, not that whatever you're studying is important, you know, to the future of your soul, but rather the use of mind is what's important. How much control are you taking of yourself through the day? You know, controlling, you know, like it was said, the adept is someone who controls all of the elements of his body, including the emotions. Am I someone who often has a knee-jerk reaction to things that actually really don't matter? If so, then what's really in operation there? Is it the lower nature or the higher? We can make choices and take positions where we are more prepared for anything in our life as we know it, to respond to things in practical, positive, building, constructive ways, to build relationships with people around us, to change the course of our lives, all by making certain choices rather than to be acted upon by other people's choices. And, you know, as we do that, we step in the direction of a more self-controlled person, and that to its philosophical end, that's all an adept is. Opportunities over the course of lifetimes present themselves to the soul who's on a path of self-control and who uses his inner nature in service to others, rather to make a buck. That's what's going on with these psychics and mediums. It's a shame, it's unfortunate. It's a lost opportunity.
So we're told that people are current in space. So that's why we learn the philosophy and try to practice it. It's not just, it's altruism. The United Lodge of Theosophists does not engage in any outside activities. Each one of us is to determine what good we want to see in the world and try to bring it about. Not collectively, we study collectively. We're association of students. We discuss things collectively, but we apply individually. And we are the adepts, the Mahatmas, the masters, and they all have really perfected themselves. They don't have any personal karma. They're working within the law, which is the second fundamental. Karma reincarnation, it's the law.
Which JCS? JCS, did you have a question?
I wasn't done.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was not done. Never mind, JCS, go ahead.
So what role does reincarnation play in this whole thing? Why are there sensitive individuals and others are completely insensitive? So there's this range of ability. And if somebody is investing in this passivity for profit, how would that influence future incarnations? Or is it a one-time only danger?
So what is the karma of mediumship? Let's start with what is the karma of, whether they know it or not, what's the karma of deceiving people about spiritual issues? So that's one view to take. Another view to take is that the physiology of the medium is what Mr. Judge calls is disorganized. Why? Because that other entity needs to use the central nervous system of the medium to operate through the body. And in doing so, that it disengages in a certain way from the immortal soul. And that is a connection that should not be tampered with. And so in that sense, there's a physiological disorganization. Well, if the medium continues on this path, what is the karma? What are they setting up for the future life? Well, if they're deceiving people about things that are spiritual, they will be born into circumstances which will continuously deceive them until such a time where they're willing to make the effort and are frustrated with the suffering they're experiencing and are willing to turn the tide, to open themselves up to a different way of being. Any other suggestions out there?
Well, we only have a minute left, so let's just try to do a quick recap here. So this idea of seances, which is the title, it embodies all the psychic practices and really hypnotism as well. And it all has to do with putting oneself in a passive state, which we are warned again and again and again not to do that, which includes daydreaming, which was not addressed at all during this session, but we do talk about that as well. That is a passive state. So it's passivity that kills the will. We are mind beings. We are electromagnetic, dynamic beings. We people our current in space. And we do this through thoughts. Thoughts are things. The real plane of action is the mental plane of action. So carry that through the day, through the week, through the month, and through the years. We are mind beings, and we're here to try to love one another and to treat each other kindly. Have a good day. Bye.